content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, How Much Blood Is Your Fun Worth? By Tyler Austin Harper. During my first semester of teaching while in grad school, I made a habit of showing up to my classroom half an hour early. I was green as a sapling and felt wholly unqualified for the task before me, and I had the vague sense that arriving before anyone else and looking prepared was one way to earn the respect of students, who were barely younger than I was. The second week of classes, coffee in hand and the day's reading tucked under my arm, I arrived to find an undergrad crouched in front of a half-open window. He was taking a photo with his phone, and when he saw me, he jumped. My presence was unexpected. The student, whose name I was struggling to recall, screeched the window shut and turned to face me. His cheeks were flushed red. When I asked if everything was all right, he said he was making sure the windows opened. My mom told me to always check to make sure they work, just in case, you know. His voice trailed off and his face turned more crimson still. I must have looked confused because he continued, in case some gun nut with an AR-15 tries to shoot up the place. When a new semester starts, my mother makes me send her a photo of the open windows in each of my classrooms. I tried to come up with something to say and found I could not. She's a little paranoid, I guess, he offered. Then another bleary-eyed student shuffled in and the conversation ended. Last night, as I sat on my couch and watched CNN anchors discuss a mass shooting that left 18 dead and 13 injured in Lewiston, Maine, the little city where I teach at Bates College and where I lived until recently, I thought about my terrified students who were sheltering in place, about my colleagues who live in town who could have been at the bar or bowling alley where the violence unfolded, about my former neighbors on whose porch my wife and I had spent many evenings drinking wine and talking politics. I thought about the hospital workers who were in the middle of the worst night of their life, and, as the child of a retired police officer, about the sons and daughters and spouses waiting at home while their loved ones ran toward the danger rather than away from it. I thought about all the people waiting for news, or getting news. And for the first time in years, I thought, too, about that student in that window, open to prove to his worried mother that he had an escape route. His phrase, gun nut, came to my mind again and again as I exchanged worried, confused, furious messages with co-workers and students. As the night wore on and surreality gave way to cold reality, my grief slowly gave way to guilt. I felt guilty and complicit and in some imprecise but unshakable way culpable for the violence on my television and social media feeds. I felt for the first time like I was part of the reason that mothers have to ask their children for photos of open windows, that I was part of the reason America is a country where college campuses and bars and bowling alleys are all too often shooting galleries. I felt guilty because gun nuts are, whether I like it or not, my people. I grew up in gun country. I spent my teenage years working at a Pennsylvania gun club. I've been a gun owner nearly my entire life. In Walker Percy's classic novel, The Moviegoer, the titular protagonist observes that mass media can make it feel like the only places that really truly exist are big cities. When you unexpectedly see your small town on the silver screen, however, you get a fleeting sense that you belong to an important place. Where you call home, he says, has been certified. If you see a movie which shows his very neighborhood, Percy writes of the moviegoer, it becomes possible for him to live, for a time at least, as a person who is somewhere and not anywhere. Last night, a place where I work and a place I called home was certified in the grimmest possible way. I am embarrassed to say that this is what it took, a place I love to become, I love to become somewhere that uniquely American tragedy has taken place, for me to fully understand our country's mass shooting problem. The honest truth is that I have always viewed the gun violence epidemic and my relationship to it as a gun owner as an abstraction, remote from my own life or choices. Like many gun owners, I had always supported stronger gun control. If it requires written and practical exams and dozens of hours of training to earn the right to drive a motor vehicle, I have never understood why the same should not apply to firearms. But my views on gun control have also been wonkish, academic in nature. It is something I care about and have even written about, but have never felt deeply. That changed yesterday as I found myself racking my brain, wondering if I had ever heard of my students or colleagues or friends or neighbors mention Shemengi's Bar and Grill, wondering if someone I knew could have been there, wondering if I was going to get the call or the text or the email. Today, as my wife and I stay locked in our home, the gunman still on the loose is the subject of a sprawling manhunt. I am filled with nothing so much as rage. Rage at my gun nut friends from home who will see this tragedy as a reason for less gun control rather than more of it. Rage at every conservative pundit who has ever uttered the phrase, good guy with a gun. Rage at the state of Maine, which has some of the most lax gun laws in the country. Rage at the politicians here and beyond who have refused to solve a problem for which solutions readily exist. Rage at myself for being so blind. If you had asked me before yesterday why I own guns, I would have fed you the same line I have fed my liberal friends and my wife, and above all myself, for years. I would have told you that I own guns for hunting, for protection, for blasting clay pigeons out of cloudless October skies. I would have told you that I own guns because I come from a gun family, and guns are some of the only things I have left from people I have loved. I would have told you about the rifle that my holler-born Great Depression-surviving grandmother kept under her bed, the 20-gauge my grandfather used to bring home Thanksgiving turkeys, the 30-06 that my father's took my father's first deer. I would have told you I own guns because I am a hunter, and I own guns because I write things that sometimes makes people angry. But it is only now that the gun violence has visited my little corner of the world that I have been forced to confront reality, a truth that has been there all along, but that I have refused to admit. I own guns because I like them, and because I am an American, and I am allowed to, and no one stops me. I own guns because, until this moment, gun violence was something that happened anywhere else and not somewhere close to me. I own guns because I have never been forced to question, to really question, why I do or what they're for or what would happen if I had to work a little harder for the right to own them. You might find this confession myopic or selfish, but it's also the truth. And I'm admitting it because I think the root of our country's gun problem is that we refuse, gun owners and gun critics alike, to say this truth out loud. We have made the gun debate a conflict over facts and motivations and laws and amendments. Gun control advocates rightly point out that guns do not, in fact, make anyone safer. That the majority of mass shootings are not ended by the mythical good guy with a gun, but by law enforcement or suicide. That buying a gun makes you more likely to die of a gunshot wound, not less. The Second Amendment crowd argues that self-protection is a right granted by God and the Constitution, and that a degree of risk is the price to pay for living in a free society. I have neither the patience nor the energy to rehash these debates, and I don't think there's any point in arguing about policy right now. There is zero reason to expect that meaningful laws will be passed as a result of the events that transpired in Lewiston. So rather than rattle off a list of warmed over ideas such as assault weapons ban or mandatory background checks or red flag laws or common sense gun reform that are probably not going to come to fruition tomorrow or the day after, I'll just resort to being honest. The inescapable fact is that the only people capable of shifting gun conversation in this country are the people who buy them. I am, like most Americans who own guns, responsible. Yesterday's events haven't made me change my mind about being a gun owner. The reasons that motivated me to own guns in the first place are no different today than yesterday. The shooting in Lewiston changed my mind about being a quiet gun owner. I have spent years of my life making apologies on behalf of my gun nut acquaintances, staying silent when friends bring up the National Rifle Association, despite my fierce opposition to that organization, not pushing back when they call minor reforms, such as mandatory waiting periods, totalitarian, changing the subject rather than asking, why do you need a military-style rifle? As a gun owner from gun country, I'll let you in on the dirty little secret that everyone knows in their heart of hearts. The AR-15 is America's best-selling rifle, not because people need them for protection, or because our country is full of aspiring militiamen or paranoid whack jobs waiting for civil war. People own AR-15s because they think they're sexy and cool and manly, because they have barely any recoil and army surplus ammo is cheap, because their buddies have them, so why shouldn't they? Because they are toys, the most dangerous toys in America, but toys nonetheless. Mothers must ask their sons for pictures of open windows because Americans own AR-15s, and they own them because they are fun. And if the past 24 hours have convinced me of anything, it is that the only way things are ever going to get better is if more gun owners start asking our friends the one question that matters. How much blood is your fun worth? Next, Why So Many People Hate Winter by Olga Kazan. I do not know if winter people actually exist. All I know is that I'm definitely not one. I view this wretched season's icy winds, frozen slush, and musty parkas not as a natural and unavoidable part in the American North, but as a personal attack on me. To be clear, this is not darkness-induced seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. This is me being MAD that it's not 80 degrees out. I do not ever feel hygge. There's usually a day in mid-January when I grouse that the weather forecast is yet again 38 and raining, and angrily order another pair of those important touchscreen gloves that I keep losing. Then I realize there's still more than a month to go. This attitude comes even as a shock to me, since I was born in Russia and lived in St. Petersburg until I was 3. This means that I not only am I failing at winter, I'm failing my countrymen. I've long wondered if I can blame my inability to tolerate cold temperatures on West Texas, where I grew up and where people cheerfully ask, "Hot enough for you?" as the sun slowly grills your corneas. The question in my hometown was never whether it was too cold to go outside, but whether it was too hot. Clothing strategies centered around covering up most of the skin without soaking in your own sweat. You would don the thinnest t-shirt, run through the neighbor's sprinklers, and hope you made it to your friend's house before dehydration set in. Then I came to Washington, D.C. for college. I bought my first winter coat. I also seriously considered transferring to a school back home. It turns out that while Texas's endless sunny days might have played a role, there are other reasons underpinning my winter hatred. Research suggests that there are two kinds of people who tolerate the cold very well: indigenous Arctic groups and men. And the more people are exposed to cold temperatures, the better they acclimate. Over the course of centuries, people who live in polar climates have evolved to be slightly more stout and have shorter limbs, so they have less surface area compared with their body mass from which to lose heat. Given my elk-like appendages, I assume that whatever shtetl my Russian ancestors hailed from was not quite polar enough. Other studies suggest that polar peoples tend to have more brown fat, which generates heat. For several years, American anthropologists have been collaborating with Russian scientists to measure the basal metabolic rates, or BMRs, of the Yakut people of the Sakha Republic of Siberia. In Yakutsk, the Sakha's capital city, winter temperatures hover around minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. The basal metabolic rate is how much energy your body burns just to keep you alive, and a higher one reflects greater heat production. The scientists have found that Siberians have higher BMRs than people who live in lower latitudes, and that translates to them both needing more calories to stay alive and feeling warmer when it's cold outside. The Siberians' BMRs rev up to even higher as the temperature drops. According to one of the lead researchers on these studies, the Northwestern University anthropology professor William Leonard, this effect is consistent across other cold climate populations. Being a non-Siberian Russian can't help me in this department. When Leonard and his colleagues compared with indigenous Siberians with non-indigenous Russians who just happened to live in the area, the Russians still had higher than average metabolic rates, but the indigenous Siberians' rates were even higher. With long-term repeated exposure to cold, all humans have some capacity to increase their acclimatization to cold, Leonard says, but those populations with a deep evolutionary history seem to have genetic adaptation. The way the Siberians' bodies generate these high metabolisms is by increasing their uptake of thyroid hormones, the chemicals released by a gland that sits in the neck. However, people who don't have this adaptation shouldn't just take synthetic thyroid hormones to try to replicate the effect, Leonard says. Doing so might confuse your thyroid so that it no longer functions normally. Indeed, Leonard says that there are a lot of thyroid problems among the elderly Yakut, suggesting that not even this natural cold weather adaptation is consequence-free. On the plus side, having a higher BMR does make the Yakuts somewhat less likely to gain weight. Compared with the tropical Bolivian populations Leonard has studied, the Yakut have better cardiovascular health, even though they tend to have stockier bodies than the Bolivians do, and both groups' diets have changed over the years. BMR also helps explain why men of all nationalities tend to be better at tolerating the cold than women are. Women are often too cold at work because office building temperatures are set to the men's higher metabolic rates, according to a 2015 study on female thermal demand, which is my new term for the fights I start with my boyfriend over our apartment's thermostat. Men, the study found, might be comfortable at temperatures as much as 5 degrees lower than women are. Even if you don't have the heavy genes of a Yakut, you can still learn to love, or at least tolerate, the cold. There are always behavioral adaptations like putting on warm clothing or going for brisk walks. Oli Jay, a professor in thermoregulatory physiology at the University of Sydney, once lived in Ottawa, where one of the coldest capital cities on Earth. My first year there, I was miserable in the cold in the winter, he told me. The best thing I ever did was spend $7.50 on a fleece thing that could cover my nose, cheeks, and ears. It made such a difference to my level of discomfort. Jay told me that people can psychologically adapt to the temperature outside if they are exposed to it for about 10 days or more. That's why these last few 40-degree March days feel so much warmer than the first 40-degree day of November. He and others have found that people who are exposed to the cold more often tend to shiver less and feel less cold, which suggests that their bodies got better at keeping them warm from the inside. As you become more acclimated to the cold, your body becomes more effective at delivering warm blood to the extremities. Your core temperature goes up, and all that contributes to being more resistant to the cold, Leonard told me. That means the only cure for hating winter, unfortunately, is just more winter. Our third article today is from the ideas section. Too many people own dogs, by Rose Horowitz. Marcia Munt was 47 when she adopted her first dog. It was 2020, the height of the pandemic, and her house felt empty. Maisie was a 9-week-old bundle of cream-colored fur and lopsided ears, but Munt, a consultant in Sacramento, soon became convinced that the dog was not normal. Maisie howled at any stimulus. She paced all night and pounced on anyone who came to the house. Munt, who had only ever owned cats, couldn't understand why anyone would choose to have a dog. "I had been the best dog mother I could be," she told me, but she spent much of that first year in tears. Maisie's vet prescribed fluoxetine, better known as Prozac, but it ruined the dog's appetite. Munt then turned to Melissa Bain, a veterinary behaviorist with a wider pharmaceutical arsenal. Maisie now takes venlafaxine, an antidepressant, and gabapentin, a anticonvulsant, with an option for the sedative clonidine in particularly fraught situations. "It's a bit of a cocktail that is always being adjusted," Munt said. She spends hundreds of dollars each month on Maisie's care and considers it well worth it. Perhaps the most valuable treatment Bain offered, however, was for the human, not the dog. "Honestly, it just felt cathartic in many ways," Munt told me. She said, "It's Maisie. It's not you. You have done everything you need to do." The rise in anxiety among American humans has been exhaustively documented. With much less fanfare, we also seem to have entered the age of the anxious canine. Last fall, the New York Times wellness column offered earnest advice on how to handle your pet's anxiety, the author reporting that veterinarians were observing an uptick in stressed-out animals, noted that two of her editors had cats on Prozac. In a 2016 study, 83% of veterinary general practitioners reported prescribing dogs anti-anxiety medication. Although there were no comprehensive statistics on the share of dogs on prescription anxiety meds, more than half of American dog owners said they are buying calming products, including pheromone spray and Lycra jumpsuits, according to the American Pet Product Association's 2023-24 Pet Owner Survey. Google searches for dog anxiety have roughly tripled over the past decade. Many of America's 85 veterinary behaviorists are booked months in advance. The seven I spoke with said the number of people seeking pet mental health care has exploded in the past few years, but there is no consensus as to why. One theory is that dogs today are really more anxious. Rather than buying from the breeder, more Americans are choosing to adopt. According to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, shelters are euthanizing nearly two-thirds fewer animals than they were a decade ago. Adoption saves lives, but it sometimes leaves traumatized pets with inexperienced owners. Meanwhile, we've also altered the way pets live. Pet dogs and cats used to spend more time outside. Now, experts told me, they're much more likely to stay indoors. When they do go outside, they're kept on leashes or under supervision. As Americans have fewer kids, they begin to think of their pets as children and to act as helicopter fur parents, the bioethicist Jessica Pierce told me. Animals tend to live longer under these conditions, but they miss out on mental stimulation and interaction with their own species. That might make them anxious or aggressive toward people and other dogs. The pandemic dog buying spike heightened all of these dynamics, as millions of dogs spent their first years socially distancing. Still, the proliferation of medicated dogs might say more about their owners. Vet behaviorists are mostly clustered in liberal areas. So are human anxiety diagnoses. Amy Pike started her career practicing in rural Kentucky, where her client list was short. Now she serves pet owners in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and business is booming. In Pike's view, that's because her new neighbors have a healthy respect for the science around pet mental health and medication. She and other vet behaviorists believe that dogs have always been anxious and that the welcome destigmatization of human mental health issues has allowed us to finally recognize their suffering. But it could be that anxious adults are projecting their own issues onto their furry companions. Some dog owners have clearly begun to pathologize normal dog habits. A 2019 survey concluded that 85% of dogs had behavioral problems. Repetitive behaviors like digging in the yard or displaying a tennis ball fetish qualified, as did excessive barking. What people classify as behavioral issues, said Pierce, the bioethicist, reflects human expectations as much as the dog's nature. So is dog anxiety crisis real, or is it a product of owners' anxiety-riddled psyches? Dogs can't tell us how they're feeling, so we'll probably never know. But both explanations are depressing. Either humans are stressing dogs out so much that they truly need prescription meds, or owners are putting their dogs on unnecessary psychoactive drugs to address annoying but normal dog habits. It might be time, in other words, to reevaluate the way we approach dog ownership. Many Americans don't have the time, energy, or green space their pets need to thrive. If the choice is to medicate our dogs or make them and ourselves miserable, pet ownership starts to seem ethically murky. Ideally, a lot fewer people would own dogs and cats, Pierce told me. That's a hard message for pet lovers to hear. When I was growing up, my family had a Labradoodle named Trixie. For much of her life, she was a dog park dog, happiest when chasing tennis balls and sniffing puppy butts. But that, about halfway through her 15 years, she was bitten by another dog. After the incident, Trixie snarled and snapped at other dogs she met. We spent less time at the park. My conversations with pet behaviorists made me wonder if we failed her. It hadn't occurred to me to slather Xanax in peanut butter and slip it into her kibble. Had I missed the signs that my dog needed treatment? I asked Bane, the veterinary behaviorist, about this. I could sense that she thought the answer was yes, but she was gentle about it. Were you a bad owner when your dog barked at other dogs? She asked. I began fumbling out a response, but she interrupted me. No, no, no. You weren't, she said. You didn't know any better. It was kind of her to reassure me. But I was still left to wonder whether medicating dogs is in their best interest or ours. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.